Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Richard Marsh. I am here representing Logic Servicing and Wisink, Inc. In this appeal. I wish I could bring you a better record than I did, but I brought you a record that nonetheless does not support the summary judgment that was granted by the Court on August 30, 2013, and then used as the predicate for granting the order of dismissal later in March of 2014. Your standard, as you know, is de novo. The questions of fact are in two basic categories, I think. One concerns the back and forth between Mr. Himes' original letter in March of 2012, his affidavit that supported the complaint, I believe, in the Republican part of the case, and then his deposition testimony. There are ways to reconcile that testimony, with the last word being Mr. Himes saying, "I never declared default, and I never sent a communication to Logic Service declaring a default." You can reconcile it that way and find that he did not declare a default.
This is the deposition testimony you're referencing now, correct?
And what I've done, Your Honor, is I've made an assumption that you've read the March 13 letter notifying the default, giving the opportunity in 15 days and all that. And then there was later an affidavit. Yes, and so I'm referring to the deposition testimony.
On the other hand, there was the affidavit, which does say, in essence, there was a default.
And so that was the point I was
So there's a conflict between the deposition testimony he gave and the affidavit submitted to the Court. That's what you're saying, correct?
Exactly. And with that conflict, we have a conflict of fact,
right,
disputed
now,
fact.
Let me just pursue this.
Yes.
The affidavit was attached to the, I guess they would call it the defendant's motion for summary judgment, correct?
It was used in that connection.
The court looked at it or relied on it. But
yes.
The deposition testimony was not submitted by your clients in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, was it?
Not at that time.
In fact, it wasn't submitted until the motion for reconsideration was filed about 4.5 months later.
That's correct.
So the deposition testimony that you say created a conflict wasn't even in the record. It wasn't even attached to some other document that had been earlier filed. Is that correct?
Those are all correct propositions. However, I think the trial court has, by rule, the duty before the case is sent upstairs to review the entire record on any motion that is filed.
How is the court supposed to review deposition testimony that's not in the file? Depositions are not filed under our rules.
Well, there were portions of it that were filed in the 4.5 months later motion to reconsider.
All right, but that motion was denied on the grounds of untimeliness.
But what I'm saying is that motion gave the opportunity to the judge to reconsider the judge's summary judgment motion because there were new facts that were introduced by way of that motion.
I was really just trying to clarify what was in the record because you say they have a duty to review the record, and to me that means something that's before the judge at the time she's making her decision, and Mr. Himes' testimony was not before at the time she made her initial decision.
Mr. Rawlings' testimony was, however.
Okay, let's explore that for a minute.
All right.
Okay. Excerpts from Mr. Rowling's testimony were attached to the motion for summary judgment,
yes,
but not the pages that you're telling us to look at now that suggest there had been, I'll just call it performance, okay? Those pages weren't in front of the judge at the time, were they?
Some of the performance, if you go performance, yes, I think they were, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think maybe you mean to limit it to the testimony about what Mr. Himes said and didn't say at the meeting with respect to default.
All right, that second part was not before the judge.
I could be corrected because I put together the motion for reconsideration and I did not add that testimony at that time.
Okay, correct. That's right. There was an exhibit attached to a motion to add Wisink as a party or motion for Wisink and something to that effect.
All right.
Filed way before all this happened.
That's correct. Several months before the summary judgment.
So which was attached Rollins' deposition?
If you're asking, do I know the record that well?
Yes.
At some point, Rawlings' testimony was attached by Ms. Secor and her clients
at the time,
prior to the date the summary judgment.
At the time the judge decided, August 13, in the record somewhere was the Rawlings' deposition.
Yes.
But no one called to the judge's attention, at least your clients didn't call to the judge's attention at the time she decided the summary judgment, correct?
I've acknowledged that in my opening
statement. So your position is the judge should have looked through the record, found Rollins' testimony, read it, and understood that that testimony, which wasn't directly before her, would have created a issue of fact.
The rule on summary judgments requires the trial judge to look at the record. It doesn't say somebody has to point it out. It doesn't say it has to be convenient. It says the judge will look at the entire record to determine whether summary judgment is warranted.
But what do you do then with the cases that say, and I'm going to misquote a little bit, that say, we are not pigs looking for a truffle, and we don't have a duty to search, you know that case I'm talking about.
I may have read it.
Yeah, that judges don't have a duty to, they have a duty to look at the record that's put before them, of course, but do they really have a duty to go search through documents that might be in the file to see if there's anything there that supports a position, and in this case, that hasn't even been argued to the judge? It seems like an awful high burden to put on the trial judge, is what I'm suggesting.
And the second point to that is that by the time, before the judge made final orders in this case, in fact, before the judge made the final order dismissing the major significant claims, there was pending before it a motion for reconsideration that had that conflicting testimony, calling the judge's attention to it and saying, Judge, don't send a record up that has this conflicting testimony in. You need to deal with this testimony. Instead of ruling on that, she pushed the motion off in a different direction for a different reason. However, she had the knowledge before she entered final orders in this case.
Right. She denied the motion for reconsideration as untimely.
That's what I
mean. Which I guess it was, because it was 4.5 months after the, well.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was untimely. It was filed before the case was made final. There's nothing about finality in a trial court motion before the case is final that I'm aware of. It may have been inconvenient for her, but it was filed nonetheless, and it put that information in the record.
Mr. Marsh, let me ask you, you've made an assumption that I'm not sure I'm on board on the premise, that on a summary judgment pleading motion that the court has any obligation to review the record. I guess I'm not sure what cases you're relying on. I know that there's case law that says if the opposing party doesn't respond, the court can't just rely on that. It doesn't relieve the moving party of the burden to establish the grounds for summary judgment. But I guess I'm not familiar with law that says the court has to go through the whole record to see if there's a fact question.
Well, Your Honor, I want to say it's in the rule itself, in the language of the rule, and I'm not sure I have that cited anywhere in our briefing.
All right, now I want to take your time.
Yeah, so I'll start with that, but I believe it's stated in the rule that the court searches the record. The word search is not used, but that based on the record and the pleadings, the court shall determine whether summary judgment is appropriate. That's where I would start.
Okay, thank you.
Hyams' testimony, I submit, if we're permitted to have the deposition testimony in there, and even without it, with Rawlings' testimony in the record, the judge had information showing there was conflict over what Heim meant and when he said things at different points in time, with or without his deposition testimony. The other basic issue concerns whether there was any demonstration of performance of this assignment agreement. If I can take you through a couple of minutes of that, I'm going to try and reserve 3 or 4 minutes. There are the section focused on in the briefing was section 6, which sets forth defaults and remedies. All the two paragraphs that were relied on both refer to obligations of logic servicing. Earlier in the agreement under section 4 are defined certain duties and obligations of logic servicing. And if you look at 4A, it talks about issuing preferred shares. If you look at 4B, it talks about identifying the three preferred shareholders. And 4C is to create a special dividend account. And then 4D about allowing inspections. The evidence is in the record showing that Logic Servicing issued preferred shares, 271 and 72 of the record. It issued them to the three persons that it was required to under 4B. And the testimony from Rawlings is he created a special account on the Logic Servicing books to keep track of the dividends. There's no requirement in the agreement to open a bank account. It's an account to keep track of the dividends. As to number four, there was never a request prior to the March 2012 meeting to inspect books or to otherwise visit the business. So under those obligations, they were performed.
Well, let me ask you on that, Mr. Marsh. I know you want to reserve some time, which is fine. My memory is that, and I'll say defendants for ease, Ms. Secor's clients say all that stuff, to the extent they did anything, it happened almost 2 years before, and there was this very lengthy period of time where nothing happened. Is that correct?
No, because the next, what I was about to get into,
great,
are the acts that took place in between. So if you do nothing else to learn about what progress was made, read the report on commercialization starting at page 493 of the record. You'll see that the assets were secured by way of foreclosure. The basic plan of the business was put in place. It was grow incrementally by sales and not try to find an angel investor. They tried that. Tony Mears said this was his fourth time with a fourth group of people trying to do this, dating back to 2000. He dumped every ship along the way, and then he dumped our ship when we weren't going fast enough. That report on commercialization, we had fully costed bill of materials, we had manufacturers ready to go, we had current inventory for 50 to 75 foot rails, we had marketing materials in place, we had four commissioned salespersons, we had sent the sales force to Florida several times, we had sales presentations that were stylized. We had done a key piece of testing through a company called Imana.
Where in the record do we find these things? Is this in Rollins?
This is in the report on commercialization.
I'm sorry. How did that? When did that get placed in the record?
That was placed in the record by Ms. Secor, page 493. I don't remember which document she used to support it, but it was submitted by her before the motion for summary judgment, so it was in the record. The product testing was recommended by the Coast Guard. We went to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard says you've got to get testing, and the best place in the business is Imana. Most important, in September of 2012, there was a dividend declared on the preferred shares of $2 at a time when Logic Servicing did not know that Mr. Mears had acquired those shares. And very shortly thereafter, I think October, November, the record would show that we were in litigation. So that dividend has not been paid, but there was a dividend declared. Those are other acts of performance which I submit do not thwart the purposes and are more than substantial, and they certainly are timely in that they were done by the time the request was made for the audit, so to speak. I'll reserve my final time.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Ms. Secor.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Secor, attorney number 25394 in Colorado. I want to point out that Logic Servicing does not actually provide any facts that were in dispute that the court didn't consider in entering summary judgment. Because Logic Servicing was completely lacking from appearance in the litigation. We had trouble getting them to appear to continue the deposition of the party, of the plaintiff. They did not appear at the pretrial conference. They did not respond to three motions that were pending in July and August of 2013. So you'll notice in the order, granting summary judgment, the court specifically identified her duty, and that was to make sure that there was, in fact, no material issues in dispute and to look at everything presented to her, even though Logic Servicing did not appear to defend the motion for summary judgment. And not only that, because some discovery had been developed, I'll call them the buoyancy parties. The buoyancy parties had, in fact, made the argument for Logic Servicing, the very same argument, for the most part, that they're making before the appeal before you today. That is, we made the argument that Logic Servicing is claiming that Mr. Heim did not declare a default. And we said, but that whether or not he declares it is not the issue. If you parse through the briefs on appeal, you'll find that there is really a confusing method of the way Mr. Marsh deals with the issues. For example, he says, well, there's no requirement in the assignment agreement that we have a business plan. Well, the investors had asked for something to show that due diligence had been performed in developing this product. It was Logic itself that said, but we have this business plan that will show we're performing. And the investors, Mr. Heim said, this business plan doesn't even have any dates and deadlines. We can't tell, you are not meeting your due diligence requirement with this commercialization report. And then Mr. Marsh comes back and says, well, the assignment agreement doesn't say we have to have dates and deadlines. That's not the point. The point is you offered this plan as proof of your due diligence performance, and it wholly fails to meet the requirement of our agreement.
I'm a little confused about what you're saying. Are you saying the commercialization report was before the court at the time she considered the summary judgment motion?
Yes.
You pointed out to the court the commercialization report?
Yes.
And argue that it doesn't show substantial progress?
Correct. And one of the other issues was in discovery requests, we had asked Logic Servicing to produce all those things that are referenced in that report. We asked for the brochures. We asked for proof that they had spoken to the Coast Guard. We had asked them to produce the elements that you just asked Mr. Marsh, well, where is this evidence? It's not in the record. In fact, it wasn't produced in discovery. And we pointed that out to the court. There's no evidence of any due diligence by this company. And when you compare an email sent to them 2 years before, it's almost identical to what they are claiming is evidence now. And Mr. Marsh focuses on what they did provide. He says, well, we did do dividends, and we did open account, and we did assign shares. But at the time of Mr. Himes' deposition, he didn't even know that. They did not even tell them.
But why does that matter? So, I mean, you submitted this report, the commercialization report, and, you know, it may well be there are minimal things in there. You know, it sounds like they talked to the Coast Guard and they did these couple of things that Mr. Marsh says that they did, or at least there's some evidence that they did, or you put it in. Given that there are no deadlines in the agreement, why don't you have a fact question as whether that's reasonable, that's due diligence? And how does the court decide as a matter of law, these five things, made it up, five things they did are not sufficient?
Because the agreement itself requires due diligence towards the progress and development of the product.
And who decides that? Is it Mr. Heim's unilateral decision? I don't think that was good enough. I mean, what's the standard by which that's judged when there are no deadlines in the agreement?
The agreement says, hang on, let me get that.
Sure.
The agreement says, this is referenced in our answer brief where we reference the fact that we provided an expert report, and in the expert report we identified that the Logic Servicing did not exercise due diligence. So we had the report of the expert saying they had failed to have a specified business plan that said when they were going to actually do it. It's not a matter of was their timing fast enough or not. There was no provision of when they were going to do it. They had defaulted to try to develop things, what they called organically, one unit at a time. But the investor said that wasn't the deal. You're supposed to develop a commercial product that implies that you're going to have a production going on, producing many of these that are going to be sold to the Coast Guard and to all kinds of shipping boats and recreational boats that are going to be able to apply these to their ships so they don't sink. One unit after 2 years was, by definition, a lack of due diligence and performance. They had done nothing to commercialize this product. And the expert report also said the management was incompetent because they hadn't even developed a specified business plan.
Where was the expert report submitted? With your motion for summary judgment?
Yes.
Did the court rely on it expressly?
I do not know.
Okay.
What was your question, Your Honor, that last week?
did the court rely on?
Whether the court cited or relied on the expert report? I mean, I'm not sure, you kind of answered Judge Gabriel's question. What the contract says, I think you went to get a copy of it, is that a default occurs if there's non-performance or unsatisfactory performance or failure to make substantial and timely progress towards performance. And his question was, who decides that? Mr. Heim unilaterally? The court? A jury?
It specifically says after that what lack of performance is, and that's the failure to...
Make substantial progress.
No, it's defined as a sufficient lack of performance to thwart the purposes and objectives of this agreement in whole or in part. And so what did we have before the court? We had the affidavit of Mr. Heim. We had the testimony that another member of Buoyancy had already determined that that had occurred. We had the affidavit of Mr. Mears that said, even after you were notified that this hasn't occurred, 7 more months have gone by and you have done nothing towards that. You have given us no evidence that you have done this. And there's no contradictory evidence given to the court to say that that did not occur. So simply saying it's a fact question isn't sufficient to overcome it in this case where there's so much evidence tilted against the other way. So for example, in the case of a waiver, did a waiver occur or didn't it occur? Could you ever decide that on summary judgment? No, the jury has to determine the intent. Did the person intend there to be a waiver? In this case, there has to be to have overcome what was presented in several affidavits and deposition testimony that there was a complete lack of performance and due diligence. There had to be some admissible evidence to contradict that.
My concern is there wasn't a complete lack of performance. I mean, they did, maybe it was very minimal things, but they did something. They did talk to the Coast Guard. They did open this account, whatever. I understand that it was really minimal. And the question that I'm struggling with some is, it's not a zero. It may be a two, but it's not zero. Well, and how do we, again, with no way to measure what's unsatisfactory performance, the definition is what you read. It's who decides? I mean, how does the court say that those four things you did are, as a matter of law, not due diligence? Now, maybe what you're telling me is, and I remember there was an expert, I don't remember, you know, who the expert was. I mean, was it a...
Jeffrey Bartholomew.
And who was he? Some expert in this industry? Or?
Yeah, he was a patent. He was an attorney and a patent expert, and someone who was an expert in business development.
All right. So he opined, I take it, that these are the kind of standards for what due diligence is.
Correct.
All right, and that was unrebutted.
Correct.
Okay.
And there was no expert report filed, and they didn't even submit their own affidavit rebutting his statements in his expert report.
Well, nothing was submitted.
That's right. And even in the motion for reconsideration, they didn't even attach, well, here's what our response would have been, and here's what we would have said. And if you look at what they've even filed in this matter in their opening brief, that was all before the judge at the time, and she considered it and said, this is not sufficient to overcome what you needed to overcome for summary judgment. And with regard to the timing, I would submit that the court applied Rule 60 and said there's a reasonable time limit and you haven't met it. But I would submit there are no basis under Rule 60 that will allow a reconsideration for the motion for summary judgment at that late date. Rule 49 requires a motion for reconsideration be filed within 14 days, and it never was. They never filed anything until we submitted a motion to dismiss so we could avoid going to trial when everything had already been decided on summary judgment. And the court said, it's too late. You've had plenty of opportunities to bring up evidence on this and you haven't done it. And what you offer now doesn't overcome that. And so all the, I want to address a little bit about what you're talking about is,
Let me ask you one more time, okay? And now look at the judge's order one more time. She says the third-party defendants, so that's Mr. Marsh's clients, have not provided evidence of a genuine issue of material fact concerning their performance.
Correct.
She doesn't specifically cite any document.
Correct.
But she had in front of her this commercialization report, and she had your rebuttal to the commercialization report. Why doesn't that create a dispute of material fact? If the commercialization report says we did X, your expert says X isn't enough. Is that a material, is that a dispute of fact under this contract, which says you have to have lack of performance of thwart?
I think it's enough. This is not, I understand where you are, and that's actually where I was trying to go back to. So under summary judgment, if it's a question of fact, you can't enter summary judgment. But that doesn't mean that facts can't be disputed and you can still enter summary judgment. So you can introduce disputed facts, but the question is, are they material? So the fact that 2 years ago you did something in and of itself proves that you're lacking...
It's Judge Gabriel's fault because he didn't tell you to turn your cell phone off.
I did, actually.
In and of itself, doesn't. I'm sorry. What did you just say? You told us to turn those off.
I'm sorry.
I thought I did. I was going to use it for a timer, and I ended up doing that instead of turning it up. So
you were trying to explain this why these facts that were maybe in dispute were not material.
They're not material because what happened 2 years ago is completely irrelevant to whether or not due diligence has been exercised since then. So no due diligence had been exercised since they had been assigned the agreement. They had done some things at the beginning, but then it sat. Nothing was done.
Mr. Marsh says the opposite. Could you respond to his argument that there were some things done in between?
The things that were done in between were the things you said, do those even matter? A dividend was declared, a bank account was open on the books. So whether or not those things happened and whether or not they advised the investors that they occurred, they still hadn't cured. The whole point of the assignment agreement was to develop this product commercially, and absolutely nothing had been done to produce a product. And the issue about the dividends being paid, the reason the investors kept bringing that up was, how are you going to pay us back if you haven't done anything to develop a product whatsoever? There's no product out there to sell. And they had no answer for that. And so in that 2 years, nothing had been done. And then Mr. Mears, when he acquired Buoyancy back, the first company that he had dealings with had sold off his invention, and it was foreclosed on by Buoyancy in a foreclosure right by those investors. He acquired that back through them by purchasing it from those members. When he acquired it back, he sent a letter to Logic and said, you're in default, the agreement is terminated, we're done. And so he pointed out in his letter to them, which was before the court on the motion for reconsideration, that even after they were given notice of default, they have given us nothing and offered us nothing to show there had been any due diligence whatsoever. And the court said, that's it, that's enough.
Thank you, Ms. Secor. Mr. Marsh, you've got 2 minutes and 11 seconds left.
I'm not sure I need it all, Your Honor, and thank you. The expert report was not cited in the motion for summary judgment that was decided in August of 2013.
Not cited in the order, it was cited in the motion.
Was it decided in the motion?
I don't know. I was just saying.
I don't see it in the motion either. It doesn't mean the judge didn't look at it. She certainly didn't mention it in the order. I just want to make the record more clear.
Okay.
I did not see it cited even in the motion, and I know it was still under construction actually at the time, just having been counsel. The commercialization report, it seems to me, does clearly introduce fact issues, and you could say 2%, but it's not a 2% job to line up your turnkey supplier to get your inventory to actually produce some product. She derives one sale. The fact is that was the first sale in the history of these patents by anybody prior to Logic Servicing. So it was a big event. We actually made a sale. And we could prove that it sold. The marketplace tests whether you're performing, and a sale is the best test of that market.
Well, what do you, and I of course just made up the 2% number. I didn't mean to help. I didn't disparage you or your client.
No, I don't
was
feel
not
offended.
The intent at all.
I feel like I should be here on my knees.
All right, I appreciate that. So, what do we do with the fact that there was an expert who says, I acknowledge they did these things, but as a standard in this industry and in business development, that is not due diligence. And the court says, whether the court specifically
said... That's not what the court relied on. But I think what Judge Richmond said is apropos. There is evidence in that same record that says, okay, you have an expert that says that it's not. Here's our stuff, and we say it is. And just because he's an expert doesn't mean that he's entitled to any more
but
weight.
But what stuff did
it creates a fact issue.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm sorry.
You
say there's stuff that contradicts the expert. I mean, what stuff? I mean, he addressed what was in.
He said you needed a business plan as if it was produced by an MBA student, basically, and he had to do it by the school book instead of doing it generically as a business person. I'm running out of time.
All right.
It was an MBA product he was looking for.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Thank you, Ms. Secord. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our docket here for this morning. So the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may summon up.